Morning, Your Honors. Greg Williams, Richards, Leighton & Finger. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-counsel, Rochelle Silverberg from Wachtell Lipton. She is representing defendant PNC Financial Services Group, Inc., and will present argument on behalf of all defendants below with the court's permission.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning. Steve Norman on behalf of the National City Defendants. I'd like to introduce today Jack Newman of the Jones Day Firm from Cleveland, Ohio.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Brian Long from McGrodsky & Long of Wilmington, Delaware, representing the plaintiffs below.
Paulette Brown of Morris Nichols, Arshton Tunnel, representing Fiduciary Counselors, Inc.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rick Miller from the Wilmington firm, Ferry Joseph & Pierce. I'm pleased to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Albert Chang, the San Diego firm, Johnson Bottini, LLP. Mr. Chang has been admitted pro hoc vice, and he will be presenting argument on behalf of the appellants this morning.
Welcome.
May it please the court, I'll focus my arguments on three parts. The first two parts are based on Pazan versus DeAngelis and the due process clause. And the last part, and these first two parts are subject to a de novo review. And the third part is subject to an abuse of discretion review based on trial court's application of a six-factor test under Polk versus Good. First, this court has held in Pazan versus DeAngelis that the Chancery Court must make an explicit factual finding on the record as to the adequacy of representation before approving a settlement that involves a compromise of a monetary damage claim. There's no dispute that the federal proxy claims pending in the Northern District of Ohio are monetary damage claims, nor is there any dispute that the Chancery Court failed to make an explicit factual finding on the record as to the adequacy of representation involving the settlement below. With respect to the final judgment, where
can you comment on footnote 3 in the Chancellor's letter opinion, where he says the class action in this case meets the factors of Rule 23 and is properly certified as a class? Does that
yes
address
this? And also along that line, there was a proposed judgment that was approved by the Chancellor later on that was entered maybe 17 days after the issuance of that approval order, stating in formulaic language that Rule 23's requirement is satisfied. It is our submission that these kind of formulaic language is insufficient to meet the Pazan requirement for two reasons. First, obviously, this is formulaic and there's no factual analysis and it does not give rise to a finding of explicit determination on the record. And second, and I'm quoting Pazan at 636 Atlantic 2nd, at page 915, Pazan says that this determination of adequacy representation may be made at the conclusion of the settlement hearing or at some earlier point. Pazan clearly contemplates a serious factual finding that is beyond what the Chancellor has done in this case. With respect to our second argument, it's based on due process. The United States Supreme Court has held in Phillips Petroleum versus Schutz that there is a due process right for absent class members. with respect to an opportunity to opt out and an opportunity to be heard. The Chancellor in this case failed to consider the value of the federal proxy claims pending before the Federal District Court in Ohio. These federal proxy claims are different claims. It is our submission that they are factually different than the breach of fiduciary claims. And in that regard, the plaintiffs in Ohio also had a breach of fiduciary claim in their complaint. These federal proxy claims are based on material omissions. The standard, the elements of the claim are different from the breach of fiduciary duty claims. And more importantly, these federal proxy claims are not subject to the business judgment rule or Section 102 defenses. On these two defenses, the Chancellor below found that the breach of fiduciary duty claims were weak. That is not the case in the federal proxy claims. And even without, as the court knows, that the federal cases in pending in Ohio are practically stayed pending resolution of the Delaware case below. But even without the benefit of discovery, and even with the inadequate discovery that has been done in Delaware, we can rely on the complaints in Ohio that's on the record. And I'm quoting record, is A54-62. The VEDA complaint in the Federal District Court in Ohio, that complaint pled specific facts as to material omissions with respect to 3 points. Number one, there was inadequate disclosure in the proxy statements with respect to tax savings to PNC. In the underlying transaction, PNC would incur about $5.1 billion in tax savings, pretty much covering the entire purchase price. That material fact was not disclosed to shareholders. Second, was about the shoddy financial analysis that's done by Goldman Sachs, the financial advisor, to NCC. And Goldman Sachs based on its liquidation analysis solely on NCC's management's assumptions. And it is our contention that NCC's management is self-conflicted in pushing through this fire sale. And particularly, Mr. Peter Raskin, the CEO and chairman of the board of NCC at the time, was in a position to gain about $6 million from the transaction. And also, it is on the record that he was the person who felt very strongly in support of the fire sale that took place in this case. And contrary to Goldman Sachs's inadequate financial analysis, PNC's own advisors, Citigroup, conducted a discounted cash flow analysis on the deal, and they came to the conclusion that the value of NCC stock was worth between 2.71 dollars to $3.93 per share, and as the court knows, the NCC stock was sold in this fire sale at the paltry sum of $2.23 per share. And it is our submission that we have strong federal proxy claims pending before the Northern District of Ohio that deserve discovery and deserve, at the minimum, opt-out class from the settlement below. Our third argument is subject to an abuse of discretion review, and in support of this argument,
as to the federal claims, do they involve the same factual predicate?
It is our submission that they do not, for two reasons. Number one, the elements of the claims are different. Whether we prevail on those claims depends on whether the alleged omissions were material or not, and whether there was scienter in the minds of NCC's board and NCC's management. And the breach of fiduciary duty claims are completely based on different facts. Secondly, as stated earlier, these federal proxy claims are not subject to the business judgment rule, nor are they subject to Section 102 defenses. And as a result, they are stronger than the breach of fiduciary duty claims. With respect to our argument that the Chancery Court abuses its discretion by finding that the plaintiff below had only a remote probability of success on the breach of fiduciary duty claims, I would like to focus the court's attention to the expert witness, Dr. Gregory Brower's affidavit. It's in the record, Appendix 380 to 389. The appellees do not challenge Dr. Brower's qualification. They only attempt to challenge Dr. Brower's testimony with their own self-serving, unsubstantiated statements. And I would only point out five statements Dr. Brower made to point out the merits of the breach of fiduciary duty claims. Dr. Brower stated that out of the 125 transactions he has personally reviewed, this, the underlying transaction between NCC and PNC, was the only one that does not have a financial advisor's fairness opinion that's accompanied by or supported by an analysis by its own financial advisors. And Goldman Sachs, in this case, conducted no discounted cash flow analysis, while the financial advisors of PNC thought that a DCF analysis was important. Goldman Sachs is conflicted because Goldman Sachs stands to gain about $22 million more in its contingent fees to see the success of the underlying transaction. Goldman Sachs' due diligence on PNC lasted for 5 hours in this case. It was an overnight between, and that's in the record, in the deposition testimony, that overnight between the hours of midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning on October 24th, that Goldman Sachs conducted its due diligence on this matter. And lastly, this case is Peter Raskin. Mr. Raskin, again, was the strong proponent of this case, and as emphasized earlier, he stood to gain about $6 million from this transaction. And he was a person during the board meeting that was voices the strongest support on this matter. Now, our contention is this, that the Chancellor should have at least given some consideration to the value of the federal proxy claims before approving the settlement, or the Chancellor could have allowed an opt-out class before approving a limited settlement. The United States Supreme Court in Matthew versus Aldridge held that due process requires a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And we submit that the Chancery Court below did not give the plaintiffs and the plaintiff in Ohio and the objectors a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And as a result, we submit that this court should reverse the Chancery Court. If the court has no further questions, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chang.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Brian Long from, excuse me, Rigrodsky and Long in Wilmington, Delaware, here this morning on behalf of the plaintiffs below. I would note before I begin my remarks that in connection with the earlier argument, we appeared before the court as cross-appellants concerning the award of fees and expenses that the chancellor gave in connection with his letter opinion. We did not move for reconsideration of that decision, and I am not here to present any argument that that decision should be reconsidered today. And I'd also note that Mr. Chang, or counsel for appellants, hasn't addressed the propriety of the excuse me, award of fees and expenses as as set forth in the Court of Chancery's letter opinion. Thank you very much. With respect to the merits of my argument in support of the Court of Chancery's approval of the settlement of this matter, we respectfully submit that this court should again affirm the Court of Chancery's well-reasoned decision approving the settlement as fair, adequate, and reasonable. On April 30th, 2010, after oral argument by the parties and objections to the proceedings below, this court entered an order affirming the decision of the Court of Chancery embodied in its letter opinion dated July 31st, 2000.
Mr. Long, when we granted rehearing en banc, we granted rehearing on all issues. The fact that there was a panel opinion in this case doesn't have any meaning whatsoever for the purpose of the argument this morning.
Thank you. That fact respectfully doesn't change my assertion that the chancellor did not abuse his discretion in approving the settlement as fair, reasonable, and adequate. After this court entered the order affirming the opinion below, appellants Julia McCall, Liana Tay, and Thomas O'Rourke, and William E. Mamby, represented by Mr. Chang, moved for re-argument. I would note that counsel for the other appellants, Vedas and Rocker, have not moved for re-argument and are not present in the courtroom today. I would also note for the record that...
Mr. Long, I'm confused about why any of this is relevant to the merits of this argument. We're here today as if nothing has ever happened. This is if we're hearing the direct appeal from the Court of Chancery for the first time.
Sure. Let me cut to my point. Their arguments, appellant's arguments concerning Prezant are both procedurally improper and substantively meritless. As the court's well aware, Supreme Court Rule 14 provides the merits of any argument that's not raised in the opening brief shall be deemed waived and will not be considered by the court on appeal. Counsel for appellants never raised in the Court of Chancery any objection to class certification. Counsel for appellants never raised in their opening brief any argument that the representative plaintiffs, and there were more than eight of them, each of whom signed multiple affidavits in accordance with Court of Chancery Rule 23, were in fact conflicted and thus inadequate representatives. Counsel for appellants never once cited the Prezant case in their papers, and in fact the first time the counsel for appellants mentioned the Prezant case was at this court's oral argument. Notably, counsel for appellants did not file a reply brief in support of their opening brief on appeal. And when I say counsel for appellants, I'm talking about counsel for the McCall appellants. I'd also note that counsel for the McCall appellants made reference to the Vedas complaint that's pending, that was pending in the Northern District of Ohio. That complaint was dismissed voluntarily on May 10th, 2010. As I said, counsel for appellants never cited the Prezant case in their papers. The first time we heard of it was in the oral argument previously before.
So just so I'm clear on that point that about the dismissal, there's no federal case pending anywhere now?
That's not what I was saying. I apologize. There is at least one federal case in which counsel for appellants McCall et al. Are currently counsel. It is substantially similar to the Vedas complaint. The Vedas complaint was, I think, in large part copied verbatim from that complaint. It's still pending in the Northern District of Ohio, and it is stayed. The action's stayed pending the resolution of the outcome of the proceedings in the court, in this court, in the Court of Chancery. I also respectfully disagree with opposing counsel's characterization of the Prezant case. My reading of the Prezant case is somewhat different. My reading of the Prezant case leads me to conclude and to respectfully submit to the court that the Court of Chancery didn't err by making explicit factual findings under the circumstances present here. Under Prezant, under my reading of Prezant, the Court of Chancery would have been required to make factual findings had they actually, had appellants or objectors or someone actually challenged the adequacy of the plaintiff. And what I'd invite the court to do is reject any bootstrap argument that counsel for appellants are trying to make in that their papers can be generously led to, could be used to shoehorn an argument that because the settlement, because they argue that the settlement is not fair, adequate, and reasonable, the representation was inadequate. But I don't think that's what Prezant's talking about. In Prezant, you had a plaintiff who had clear conflicts. You had a plaintiff who may not have even had standing to assert the claims he was asserting. And you had a plaintiff who was unaware of certain goings-on in the proceedings in the Court of Chancery. Here we don't have that. Again, multiple affidavits pursuant to Court of Chancery Rule 23. No one has ever said that any of these plaintiffs have any conflict. So under those circumstances, I think based on Prezant, the Court of Chancery's inclusion in his letter opinion of the footnote 3 referenced earlier this morning and the findings in the order and final judgment that was entered on 3 weeks after the court issued its letter opinion more than satisfy Prezant. I'd also like to address the next point concerning the argument that the chancellor erred in not making some sort of explicit valuation or analysis of the actual value of the federal proxy claims that are asserted, which is asserted he should have done. One thing, one sidestep before I launch into that, and that is, I would note that counsel for appellants represents the plaintiffs in the Tharp action pending in the Northern District of Ohio. The Tharps did not object to the settlement. In any event, my reading of the claims in the Tharp action are somewhat different than counsel for appellants. My reading of those claims is that they do stem from the same factual predicate. But I would also note here that, again, they didn't raise this argument to the Court of Chancery. There was no specific reference to the Court of Chancery that it had to somehow value these claims. There was no specific argument in the Court of Chancery, or there's no argument at all in the Court of Chancery, that these specific proxy claims, unbridled from the fiduciary duty claims, had some sort of value in excess of, you know, $5, let alone $1 billion, which they're arguing. That was just never raised. And it wasn't raised in their opening brief on appeal. And in support of the argument, previously in support of the argument before the court and in their motion for re-argument en banc, they cited the MCA case. That case, just like the Prezant case, was never raised in their papers. It was never, the first time it was raised was when we got for this, we came before the court and when we had oral argument at Widener. In any event, the MCA case upon which they rely is distinguishable. In the MCA case, one need look no further than the fact that the objector's main argument was that the federal securities law claims actually predominated over the state law claims and that the claims were purely for money damages. Here, they assert equitable claims in their complaint, the Tharp complaint. It's not the Veda, it's not the McCall complaint, but the complaint upon which they're ostensibly relying. And here, even a charitable reading of their papers highlights that their main concern is that the board breached its fiduciary duty to secure the highest value reasonably attainable I'd also note that nowhere in their papers is there any mention of a de novo review standard. The only standard of review that they mentioned in their papers was that the Court of Chancery's decision should be reviewed for abuse of discretion. I'd note that we'd respectfully submit that the Court of Chancery did not abuse its discretion. Setting aside for a moment our contention that the argument about valuing the undertaking some sort of explicit valuation of the federal proxy claims was never actually raised, I still think it's meritless. The fact of the matter is, whether they say there should have been another buyer, or they should have performed, or National City should have tried to go it alone as a standalone option, there's been no suggestion that, in fact, in light of what National City was told by its regulators, remaining a standalone option was viable. There's nothing here that, nothing's been said or written that adequately rebuts the argument that Goldman Sachs also didn't believe that the remaining standalone option was viable, and thus the DCF analysis that they performed really wasn't meaningful. And finally, no one else has appeared to buy, make an offer for, or even attempt to purchase National City. In light of that fact, I respectfully submit that the claims that they're asserting in the Ohio case, especially when they're unbridled from the fiduciary duty claims, have no value, and thus, in releasing them, the Court of Chancery did not abuse its discretion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rochelle Silverberg on behalf of the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc., arguing on behalf of all defendants. First, very, very briefly on Prezant. As Mr. Long noted, the Prezant point was not raised anywhere in the appellant's briefing to this court. Prezant was not cited. There was no discussion whatsoever as to any infirmity in the Chancellor's findings. So under Supreme Court Rule 14, that argument is waived. In any event, the Prezant argument has no merit. As the court noted, the Chancellor did make the Prezant findings in footnote 3 on page 7 of his letter opinion. In addition to that, the final judgment issued in this case itself contains the Prezant findings, and that's in the record at BP page 6. It's a complete paragraph saying, based on the record in the Delaware action, each of the provisions of Chancery Court Rule 23 has been satisfied. And then the paragraph goes on to recite the specific subdivisions of Rule 23A. So the findings were made, and those findings are adequate under Prezant, and in fact, no one has contended otherwise. The McCall objectors have not raised any challenge to any aspect of Rule 23. So clearly, there was no requirement that the Chancellor go beyond making the finding that was made and is typically made in final judgments of that sort. The only objector who made any objection whatsoever to any of the Rule 23 findings was Mr. Vadis, who had a single sentence in his brief arguing that there was inadequate representation here because the plaintiffs released Mr. Vadis' claims in connection with the settlement.
Let me interrupt your argument for just a moment to see your understanding of what we're doing this morning.
Sure.
And because everyone's talking about McCall, the only argument we've heard is from McCall, and you're distinguishing Vadis. Now, we've heard that Vadis dismissed the Ohio case.
Correct.
And so far, we haven't heard anything in support of any of the arguments raised by Vadis, but we don't have a filing in this case. I'm sure Mr. Miller can tell us, but is Vadis still in this case, even though no one's making an argument this morning?
Mr. Vadis, after the settlement had been reached in the Delaware case, Mr. Vadis filed a complaint in federal court. Mr. Vadis then filed an objection to the Delaware settlement in the Delaware court. His Ohio counsel appeared in the Chancery Court, argued in the Chancery Court. When his objection was overruled, he appealed to this court. He put in an opening brief in support of his objection. The defendants put in an answering brief responding to the points made in his objection. Mr. Vadas decided not to submit a reply brief in response to the arguments made in defendant's answering brief. And during oral argument in the first hearing in this case, Mr. Vadas ceded his time to the other objectors. Once the order issued in this case, Mr. Vadas did not seek rehearing in bonk, and he voluntarily dismissed his pending federal complaint. And so far as I know, that's the last I've heard of Mr. Vadas.
All right, thank you.
So going back to present, Mr. Vadas was the only person who objected to any aspect. His only objection to Rule 23 was the inadequate representation. And then in his appeal to this court, Mr. Vadas himself conceded that the Chancery Court found that the plaintiffs had fairly and adequately protected the interest of the class. And that's at Mr. Vadas' opening brief, page 5, citing to the opinion at 2. So the only objector to even raise a Rule 23 objection conceded that the chancellor had addressed that objection.
So that probably also explains why his opening brief doesn't cite present either.
Correct. So unless the court has any questions, I'm happy to move on to present. Briefly addressing the due process claim that was raised by Mr. Chang, he said in his argument that there is no dispute that Mr. Vadas' complaint asserts claims for money damages. There is a dispute on that. And in fact, if you read Mr. Vadas' complaint, he repeatedly alleges that he has no adequate remedy at law, and the only relief sought in Mr. Vadas' complaint is equitable relief. He seeks rescission of the merger, and he seeks relief regarding the return of the golden parachutes, which he claims were improperly paid. But as originally pled, obviously there's no longer a complaint. The complaint that Mr. Vadas brought was a complaint seeking purely equitable relief, not monetary relief. So that deals with the Schutz issue. Now going to the disclosure issues. In the briefing before this court, again, Mr. Vadas did not raise any particular disclosure issues. Mr. Vadas' objection was that this settlement was going to release his federal claim. But in arguing first to the chancellor and then to this court as to what his valuable claim was, his focus was on the fiduciary claims and in particular on this golden parachute claim, which he described differently in different parts of his brief. At one point, it was characterized as a duty of loyalty claim that the directors were influenced by the fact that certain members of management were going to get these golden parachutes. That claim was directly addressed and rejected by the chancellor, or a claim that it was a breach of fiduciary duty when the board originally granted these golden parachutes years ago, and we argued that that would have been a derivative claim and the plaintiff would lose standing. But there was no claim of any there was no argument or discussion in his brief about any disclosure claims that were being lost in his federal complaint. The only disclosure issues that were raised both in Chancery and in the briefing before this court were Mr. McCall. And if you want to look at Mr. McCall's disclosure issues, he raises three issues at pages 27 to 29 of his brief. And the three issues are inadequate disclosure with respect to National City's application for TARP funds. And if you actually look at the proxy, there is extensive disclosure at BD 493 to 96 with respect to the various efforts over time that National City took to obtain TARP funds. And in fact, that was one of the issues that was also the subject of the supplemental disclosures that were used in settlement of the case, that was one disclosure which, as argued in Chancery and here by the defendants, had no merit and was fully disclosed and was actually a bootstrap of their substantive claim that the board should have done more to try and get that. The second disclosure claim that was actually raised and addressed, that was actually identified by McCall was, quote, the exclusion of customary analysis by Nat City's financial advisor and why this fundamental analysis was disregarded when valuing Nat City. Again, not true. the proxy and the 8K expressly disclosed Goldman Sachs did not perform certain analyses that it customarily would have prepared, and it disclosed why, because the determination of Nat City that such forecast analysis were not meaningful as a result of the extraordinary circumstances. So again, the second disclosure claim, in fact, was disclosed, and in the supplemental disclosures that were part of the settlement, there was an additional 8K filed that disclosed that there had, in fact, been additional DCF analysis done on a standalone basis that showed a value higher than the deal value, but that was viewed to be not a viable option given the circumstances facing National City. That was the second disclosure issue. The third disclosure issue raised by McCall was that there was no disclosure of the defendant's alleged liability from current derivative suits and the effect of the merger on such liability. Again, not true. There was disclosure in the proxy that derivative actions were pending against Nat City and the directors, and that on consummation of the merger, plaintiffs who have asserted those claims may lose standing. There were supplemental disclosures in the 8K providing more information about whether the board considered these claims in its consideration of the merger, and also referring shareholders to where they could get a fuller description of what those claims were. So there were three disclosure claims raised by the objectors in Chancery Court and to this court. Those were addressed in our briefing to this court. They did not put in a reply. None of them have any merit, and they do not provide any basis to find that the chancellor abused his discretion in approving the settlement. Very quickly, he claims that the chancellor did not give them a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and that's just not, again, not correct. The fairness hearing in this case was 2.25 hours. The objectors had extensive time. At the end of the transcript, the chancellor put on the record specifically to the Ohio objectors, "Welcome to Delaware. I appreciate the fact that you have come as far as you have. I have listened carefully to your presentations. I have also read thoroughly what you have submitted. I ask your indulgence for a little time to think about this." The final judgment then has a sentence that expressly says in it, "We have considered the objections of McCall and Vadis. They have been considered by the court, are found to be without merit in all respects, and are hereby overruled." So there's no record that just because the chancellor did not say, "Here are the 20 arguments made in the brief, and here are my responses to all of them," which has never been required by this court, there's no record that the chancellor did not give a meaningful opportunity, a meaningful consideration to the objections that were made. Very briefly, they do very briefly allege to their merits claims that there was not sufficient disclosure, insufficient disclosure of some of the board's failures, but again, that's just bootstrapping the merits claim to the disclosure claim. The record that was submitted to the Chancery Court shows that this was a full, comprehensive process, a very well-informed, unconflicted board. It made a proper decision in agreeing to the transaction. The claims were very, very weak. The chancellor, in his business judgment, considered all of the arguments and did not abuse his discretion in approving the settlement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rick Miller, to answer Justice Holland's question, I was prepared today to represent the Vadis appellants, and I filed an acknowledgement of oral argument stating that I was here representing the Vadis appellants. Unfortunately, I was, until this hearing, I was without a critical piece of information, which about the dismissal of the Vadis complaint in the Northern District of Ohio. I have not been told that by my co-counsel, Mr. Cochran and Mr. Siegel, and I will need to verify that and then decide what actions I need to take based on that. And I apologize to the court for that happening. Now I'm going to turn the podium over to Mr. Chang.
Mr. Chang, can you start by telling us how we're going to be able to consider these arguments on Prezant and Phillips, since they were never cited in your opening brief and our court has said repeatedly, one good example is Rocha versus DuPont, that any item that's not fully and fairly presented in your opening brief is waived and cannot be presented for the first time at oral argument.
Thank you, Justice Holland. I start with quoting Mr. McCall's affidavit.
I'm talking
that
about your opening brief. Is the word is present or Phillips?
No.
So no. My question is, how are we going to address the argument that's presented for the first time on appeal, given all of our precedents to the contrary?
The appellees concede that the objectors below, specifically the VEDA objectors, cited or used the words adequacy of representation. That argument was made before the Chancery Court and was made before this court. It is our submission whether we cite certain case law like Pesant, like Phillips Petroleum, does not control whether we have waived the arguments. In other words, the arguments were before this court. What legal theories would allow us to prevail on those arguments is up to this court to decide. And we disagree with the appellees with regard to whether Mr. McCall raised this adequacy of representation argument below and in this court. In the joint appendix pages 400 through 400.
Well, before you get to that, I'm looking at your opening brief. And under the summary of argument in your opening brief, if you look at page 3, I can't find anything in your second paragraph talks about the attorney's fees. I don't see anything in your first paragraph that talks about adequacy of representation.
Sure, but before the Chancery Court and before this court, on the record on appeal in this court, Mr. McCall's affidavit states, and I'm quoting, that he objects, he lists 7 reasons why he was objecting to the settlement, and I'm on page 403 of the record.
I don't want to use up all of your time. Let me just make an observation. You can preserve something perfectly in the Court of Chancery, and you could preserve perfectly 7 issues. When you file your opening brief, you limit the issues, whether you've preserved them or not, to the ones that are in your brief. So my simple question is, in an effort not to use up all of your time, where does your summary of argument or your opening brief in this court address adequacy of representation?
Even if this court finds that the McCall appellants or objectors failed to specifically identify adequacy of representation as an argument before this court, the VEDA objectors did. And that argument is squarely before this court. And I'm quoting reason number F on page 403 of the joint appendix, where Mr. McCall stated that he believed the additional disclosures, I'm not quoting at the moment, provided little value to NCC shareholders, particularly, and I'm quoting, when compared to the release that NCC shareholders are giving up, prohibiting them from taking further action against potential gross improprieties that may be discovered. That refers to the Ohio action, and it is worth noting that Mr. McCall is 53 years old. He himself, a financial advisor, an expert in the field, and his father was an NCC board member, an officer from 1971 to 1986. And I invite the court to read through the 3-page affidavit that he filed alleging or stating that he believed that the NCC management and the board did not breach fiduciary duties to the shareholders. With regard, I am the bearer of the information that Mr. Miller does not have about the dismissal of the Beta action. I apologize to the court. I landed at about 3 o'clock this morning and did not have sufficient time to talk to Mr. Miller about it. Mr. Veda dismissed the lawsuit solely because of this court's affirmance of the approval of the settlement below that was issued some 2 weeks ago before the rehearing was granted. And there are more than one action, actually. Not all Chinese are good at numbers. I'm missing the number, but there are more than anywhere between 5 to 12 federal actions pending, or 14A actions pending before the Northern District of Ohio. With regard to the appellee's attack on the merits of the disclosure claims, it is true that the proxy statements, the NCC's proxies made various statements about the TARP fund, about the financial analysis conducted by Goldman Sachs, and about a variety of other issues. But it is our contention that those statements were not true and they were materially misleading. And that goes to the merits of the federal proxy claims. With respect to the citations to MCA, the MCA case was decided by the Chancery Court about 10 years ago, and the MCA court did precisely what the Chancellor should have done in this case, is to disapprove the settlement below and allow the federal class actions to proceed. If the court has no further questions, I submit.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement. Recess.